Hello, welcome to Universal Soul Love. This is Detective David Love.
And this is Dr. Lana Love. Welcome to our show.
Today we have a very special guest with us, Arvind Vohra.
Arvind has been a Libertarian Party candidate and is the vice chair of the Libertarian Party. As well as that, he's the creator of the Vohra Method of Education. Arvind, you're a very busy man.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on and doing a guest interview with us. Very honored to have you.
Sure, I'm pleased to be here.
Arvind, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the Libertarian Party and also some of your views. You have some very interesting views. I understand that you consider yourself, anarchist?
I do, as a matter of fact.
And a capitalist.
And a capitalist, yeah. So let me talk a little bit about the Libertarian Party's overall views. Some people in the Libertarian Party, like me, are anarchists and some are minarchists. But what all libertarians agree is that here we need to have less government intervention. So we need to have less government involved in our personal lives. We believe we need to have less government involved in our business lives. We believe we need to have less government in our economic lives. And we think that from there, we can have a much greater level of individual greatness. And so a lot of what we try to do is to try to find areas where we can advocate to remove very large impediments created by government that get in the way of that. Some of those things range from fighting against the war on drugs, fighting against foreign wars. Some of that involves working to dramatically reduce the size and scope of government so that we can end the income taxes in America. So those are the types of things that we focus on.
Well, I did notice your Facebook webpage says materialism, and then it says minimalism, and I love that because materialism has been one of the biggest traps, I think, that it's an enticement, and it's sort of it's around the idea of ownership and possession and all sorts of things that really get us too focused on sort of, I do like the idea of capitalism.
Same time, I think you need some materialism. So I guess minimum materialism is a perfect compromise.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're looking at is actually my latest book. It just came out. It's called Materialistic Minimalism. But one of the things that I actually do talk about in that book is that the same way that minimalism can add to your personal life, it actually can be a really good way to look at government. You know, libertarians are minimalists when it comes to government. We say, let's keep the laws that make some sense, but let's get rid of all the ones that don't. Let's get rid of some of these big bureaucracies and see if we can do a lot more with actually a lot less government. That's really what we're trying to do. We want there to be more greatness for the individual by having less government, less laws, less regulations. You know, right now the federal code in America has tens of thousands of pages, and it's come to the point where most businesses and individuals don't even know if they're breaking the law anymore. And it's that type of stuff is what we really don't want to have happen anymore.
I understand that completely. I worked in the U.S. court system for more than 20 years, and I worked with law firms and government agencies, the Massachusetts Tax Department. And you're absolutely right. I mean, police don't actually go out looking for felons or enforcing search warrants, arrest warrants. They know that if they pull someone over, typically they're going to make an arrest anyhow, because most people don't realize they're walking around with at least 10 misdemeanors and a couple of felonies at any given moment. And typically they're going to get pulled over for having a light out on their car, and they're going to find out that they haven't paid their insurance, or they didn't show up for jury duty, or their driver's license expired. They're going to have to get shuffled through the court system and have that all sorted out. And I've seen it time and time again.
One of the really big things that we're working on right now is eliminating what's called civil asset forfeiture, which basically means that people who haven't been convicted or often even tried of a crime, they've just been arrested, which means there's some suspicion that they did a crime, have their assets either frozen or, more commonly, simply taken. So the police departments will simply take if they have a bunch of cash with them, and until they can prove that they got the cash legitimately, they can't have their own money back. We've seen the cars stolen where it's where the person whose car it is wasn't even the one being accused of the crime, let alone we haven't gotten convicted. We're just some guy has his car stolen who just had nothing to do with anything. Those are the types of things that are an indication of how far government has gone out of control. So we see civil asset forfeiture as something that needs to end, but we see it as also a symptom of something much deeper. That's why we're working to get rid of things like the Patriot Act, defund the NSA warrantless surveillance program. We're working to really make sure that before you are accused, before you are, you know, punished for a crime, that you've actually, you know, committed to that crime. And one of the main things that we do over there is say, is this thing really a crime? You know, the Libertarian Party believes that a crime without a victim, we don't consider that to be an actual crime. We consider that just to be locking up people for no legitimate reason.
I've worked at every level, and I've seen a lot of different situations and seen people get really...
It certainly sounds like there's a need for that.
There is. There's lots of room for reform within the government, within our society.
I mean, the government really has to be for the people. I understand you have a lot of other, ideas that really resonate with me. You know, the freedom for people to choose, for example, freedom of expression, drug policy. Now, I'm interested that you're believing in legalizing marijuana, which has, of course, always been such a controversial issue. Mm-hmm. There has been much more in recent times written about marijuana, the health benefits of marijuana. So what are your views on that?
So for us, the question of whether you're absolutely right. There are many health benefits. One of the big ones with marijuana is that it allows people to reduce the amount of other more intense pain medicines that they take. But from the libertarian perspective, even if marijuana was only harmful and had no benefits whatsoever, we believe that it is the individual's right to decide whether or not to consume that. We believe that a person should be able to enjoy themselves or do whatever they want with their own bodies without the government telling them otherwise. So we actually believe in completely removing all drug laws, getting rid of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency in America. We believe that people who are currently locked up for either buying or selling or doing anything with drugs that doesn't involve violence should be released. We don't think that they're there legitimately at all. So we strongly believe that that you should be able to enjoy yourself however you want to. As a parallel, you know, eating junk food doesn't benefit you, but it's still your right to decide whether or not you want to enjoy yourself in that particular way. We don't believe that there's any proof that you have to prove that what you're doing is healthy before you can do it.
Okay, let me be the devil's advocate here. So obviously the Libertarian Party focuses very much on the rights of the individuals.
I like that.
What about, though, the importance of the state, of the government to protect individuals? You know, especially, you know, I'm a mother of two children, adolescents. They need to be protected from drugs. We all know what sort of harm can befall children with drugs. And, you know, at that age, they don't have the sense to make up their mind. Alcohol, even, you know, alcohol causes so many problems. You know, you have other people who need to be protected from those that are reckless driving under the influence of alcohol. Even junk food. Junk food is full of really nasty ingredients. And as a child and adolescent psychiatrist, I know how much those ingredients can actually affect various, even the cognitive ability and bring out, you know, things like ADHD. Shouldn't the government have some role in protecting citizens from the greed and the nastiness of other individuals who want to make money and manipulate system?
I just want to add that we generally, in the criminal justice system, we generally call these types of crimes victimless crimes.
Sure.
And our prisons are very overcrowded.
But doesn't the government have a role in protecting citizens?
Sure. So let's think about that. I mean, it's my deep belief that each of us have a responsibility to work to look after ourselves, to look after our families, and to make sure that we and try to influence our families and friends and neighbors to make good decisions. And I believe that is a responsibility that we cannot abdicate. And I don't just mean that in a moral sense that we should not abdicate it. I'm saying that in a physical, pragmatic sense, we cannot advocate it. What happens when we do try to advocate that responsibility is what we're seeing right now, which is that many people believe in America that the government is looking after their best interests, which it often is not, and thus will follow their health advice. The result was in the 1980s, people who were trying to do the right thing, people who are trying to eat healthy, people who are saying, listen, this is a government, they must know something and they're advising me. Those who are following the government's advice were eating 6 to 11 servings of simple carbohydrates a day. That's something that we avoid today. Many people who are into health avoid entirely. But at the time, the government, most likely my prediction would be influenced by a lot of the grain lobbies in America, which are very powerful, was advocating 6 to 11 servings of starch a day. You see the same thing in education. If you believe in America that the government is – that the public school system is educating you sufficiently, then you're not going to do anything about it. You're going to say, yeah, it's being taken care of. But then you'll be wrong. And we see that people who don't realize that they're getting an insufficient product, that don't take the time to spend on their kids' education, end up not getting the results that they want. And we see that in so many areas. So to me, the idea of individual responsibility is fundamental to this. If you just start eating at random foods that the FDA says are okay to eat, if you just start blindly following the education system and assume that that's going to be enough to make you successful in both education and in life after education, that is a dangerous and toxic mindset. And that mindset itself is one of the major reasons that I'm involved in the Libertarian Party. That's one of the major reasons I'm involved in education, is that I want people to be taking that responsibility, which if they don't take, even in today's big government system, they will suffer for.
I agree with all of that. I mean, one of our fundamental principles with universal soul love is personal choice and personal sovereignty and personal responsibility. So that's all in alignment with our ideals.
That's true. I guess being a parent, I also believe that individuals do need extra help and protection. And I guess if you take that line of absolute individual responsibility, we could say that it's the community's responsibility to catch and punish criminals, not the government's responsibility.
There's a lot of discussion on them. That's an issue that's more right there in that sort of intellectually rarefied part of libertarianism, where people are asking the question, that are saying, how much more effective, what are some other ways that we can go about this? And one of the really interesting conversations that I've had a chance to be part of is really discussing not so much violent crime, but disagreements that happen between businesses. We see, for example, right now in America, the war on drugs has led to a lot of violence. But it's not because drugs by themselves make people violent when they're, you know, if somebody's selling drugs, that doesn't make them automatically violent. But just like any other business in the world, drug businesses sometimes have disagreements. And they're not allowed to use the courts. They're not allowed to call Visa. They're not allowed to call eBay or American Express or Amazon. So their only choice is violence. And part of that discussion has been discovering that in our actual interactions with each other, when there is a disagreement, when we feel that somebody has done some kind of fraud against us, once we feel that somebody has given us a product that isn't really what we expected, the common practice in America today is to turn to private sector solutions, is to turn to the free market, is to call up Amazon, is to call up eBay. If things are very extreme, to maybe call your credit card company, but it's very rare to even take something to court. So the way that many libertarians, and again, this is one of those discussions that's constantly happening. It's a kind of part of the new discussions that are going on. But one of the discussions is, what if in America the police acted the way the fire department does, which means you called them when you needed them, and if you didn't need them, they weren't there checking your cars, they weren't there harassing you at checkpoints, they weren't there doing all that kind of stuff. That they were just there when there as a service to keep the peace, to protect you from violent crimes, to protect you from theft. One of the tragedies in America is that the police have actually done their most important jobs the least well. They spent a lot of time on going after drug dealers and you know, other folks that don't really have victims. But with things like rape, which everybody agrees is a abhorrent crime, the police departments in America have tens of thousands of evidence kits, rape kits, what we call them, sitting in lockers just waiting to be processed, as in they couldn't get around to processing those. They're too busy harassing people at various checkpoints. So we do believe that the way that criminal justice is happening now, or most libertarians believe that the way that that criminal justice is happening now is not the way it should be happening. And massive changes, massive, massive changes in priorities and methods need to happen to really bring that in line towards serving the people.
Yeah, clearly.
I certainly agree with that point.
Yeah, I haven't seen very many cases resolved through the court system, whether it was civil, criminal, or domestic. Very rarely did we ever see any resolutions because people kept coming back into the family courts and until people learn to deal with their situations through mediation or some other method, the courts were rarely in a position to deal with personal situations and disputes or even criminals coming in with, or should I say, offenders. Lana, you've dealt with in mental health the complex issues that people come in with, and it wasn't just the legal issues or the mental health issues. It was unemployment, family violence, past history of violence, childhood issues, health issues, all sorts of things going on that you would need an entire team of professionals to assist them.
And certainly if the police were free to do focus on that, there'd be a huge amount of work needed there.
And police are not social workers. It's not their job to go in and try to fix all of these issues. They're there to do it when they show up. They're there to contain the situation. So I think it's more the way you're talking, I think happens more in Australia, where the police generally show up when you need them. Mm-hmm. And because typically often
it seems to be a very different system.
Often in America, when you call the police, you're the one that's going to be arrested. Because when they show up, they don't know what's going on. You may get shot. You could be the caller of the 911.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they don't know what they're going into, and it's not their job to try to separate people or get them therapy or anything else. They typically are going to make an arrest, or they're going to arrest everyone involved in the situation, from my experience.
Is a big issue. Giving back, rights to the individual and police more as a service. Right. What about your policy on gun law, gun policy? What's your position on that?
So that's a really good question. I mean, to me, there is no right more sacred than the right to be able to defend yourself. To me, the right to defend yourself is absolute. And, I don't think that just because, whether you're in America, whether you're old, whether you're young, whether you're maybe a small, not very strong woman, maybe you're the biggest, strongest, muscularest guy in the world, there's often going to be either a person or a group of people that can do physical harm to you. And the really nice thing about guns, there's two things that I really like about them. One, they're a strength equalizer. A small person with a gun and a big person with a gun are about as dangerous as each other. And that leads to a certain kind of mutual respect. What we see often in America is that the cities where there are the fewest gun laws are the cities where there's also the least crime, which comes from the second great benefit of guns, which is people who are there to do harm, legitimate criminals. I don't mean people who just want to smoke marijuana. I mean real criminals. They don't know who is armed. In all of the recent unfortunate large-scale shootings that have happened in America, they've always happened in gun-free zones. In other words, places where criminals knew for certain that the targets were not armed. And so one of the big things that we've been working on is trying to get rid of those gun-free zone laws to say that, listen, if you want to shoot up this, a nightclub, if you want to shoot up, this public park, if you want to shoot up wherever you want to shoot up, you should realize there is a good chance that somebody there is armed, or there's a chance. So you can't have that certainty of that you're going to go there and kill 50 people or whatever. You might just pull out a gun and be put down immediately. I mean, and that idea of using guns to neutralize violence is to me a very central idea. It's one of the most, I would consider one of the most important ideas in all of libertarian politics. Mm-hmm. There are those that have a much more hardline position on guns that say that in addition to protecting you from crime, if the worst happens, if we believe that a government has become completely tyrannical, then it is that last defense before that that says that that at some point that a government overreach will be met with force. So there are two sides of that.
I really appreciate your honesty and your you just really come right out and say what your position is on things. Because interestingly, I remember when I lived in Florida about 3 years before I came to Australia to meet my lovely wife, Lana, and start this radio show. I lived in a rural part of us in Northern Australia, Northern Florida, getting my countries confused. We'd go into a restaurant. We know that Florida is famous for their stand your ground laws and high crime, especially in places like Orlando and Miami. But it was funny, when I would walk into a restaurant, I could look around and I could see men with fishing shirts and sometimes I'd see the NRA caps and I'd be sitting in a restaurant. And I knew that I felt safe and protected because I knew if anyone came in there to rob the restaurant or armed and, you know, acting violently, I could look around and see who was there and who was legally licensed and armed and trained. And you knew that you'd be protected by the people sitting around you with their families. And even I noticed even in Australia, women are now becoming more and more involved in target shooting and training, and the men love it. They love having.
I guess this is a point where, as an Australian, I have a different view. We sure. Australians are very anti-guns, and I have certainly read evidence that, and I think you can always find the evidence to support your case.
You can, for sure.
But we've certainly read evidence that, you know, where there are guns around, you're more likely to use them. And certainly being involved in mental health, you know, guns are quite lethal in suicide. So I don't know. It's a difficult area.
Yeah. Look, I mean, you make a good point over there with suicide. I mean, it is interesting that most people in America actually don't know that the most common cause of gun death, at least in America, is suicide. It's, you know, people are. And I'm not trying to say that makes it okay, but it's not what people are thinking are the guns are being used for. They're thinking that guns are being used. You know, their fear is you know, somebody coming in and shooting up a school. And we're saying that's only happening in gun-free zones. So I'm actually really glad you brought that up. It is the number one thing that guns do in America is suicide. And the actual deaths from homicides in America is very low. I mean, it's lower than the number of accidental deaths from accidental falls. I mean, it's a small number. Even though that evidence kind of, it, you know, supports certain parts of the point, to us, the question isn't just, you know, what's going to lead to the fewest deaths. The question is, what natural rights do you have? So as an example, if we say that every single person in America has to eat a diet of vegetables and fish, that will reduce the rate of heart disease deaths, no question. That type of law, though, we would consider to be absolutely morally, unquestionably reprehensible and would fight it with every possible fiber of our being. And so it's the same with guns. We believe that you have a right to defend yourself. It is a fundamental, it is a natural right. It is expressed by our Constitution. But to us, it is a fundamental and natural right that says, I should not be forced to walk in an area where I feel unsafe just because I'm, you know, not the biggest, scariest person out there. I should not have to have that feeling that if somebody wants to yell obscenities at me, that they can say, because they're physically bigger than me, they don't have to worry about anything. We believe that right to be safe that comes from the ability to defend yourself is a sacred right. So we fight for it very, very seriously.
Okay, Ivan, I can see how much you focus on sovereign rights. I do love it.
That's excellent.
Let me ask you, what's your stance on suicide? And euthanasia. Do people have a right?
So that's a good question. The Libertarian Party view is that you have an absolute right to euthanasia and you have a natural right to kill yourself if you choose to. That doesn't mean we think it's good. I mean, that's one of those ideas that's very important in libertarianism, where we believe that what is that legal and good are not synonyms. So does a person have the right to kill themselves? Yeah, and on a practical level, I mean, what punishment would you give? I mean, there's no point. But But we also don't want there to be suicide. We don't think, you know, we don't, when somebody's having all these, having personal difficulties, we're not saying, oh, great, let's do suicide. We believe that if we allow more people to be involved in things like education without these narrow these narrowing regulations that restrict your creativity and ability to really help people, more people to be involved in all these areas without having that interference that gets in the way of innovation, we do believe that things like innovation, that innovation in areas like mental health can help to reduce that. So one of the major things that we push for is to work to allow people to voluntarily choose the type of help or service that they want. And that definitely applies to things like mental health. That definitely applies to things like medicine.
Can you expound on that a bit?
Sure. For example, in America, let's say that the best surgeon in all of Switzerland, in all of Australia, in all of England, you know, let's say all those three surgeons came to America and you were chosen and you had the opportunity to choose who to go to. The answer is you couldn't go to any of them. In America, none of those people are allowed to practice medicine. And to us, that is both absurd and criminal, because if when you're sick, the person who can help you the most happens to have been trained in another country, the idea that you as a sick person need to travel to that country is so absurd that we think it's ridiculous. We've also seen the effects that it has driven up the cost of healthcare. You know, if you look at cars in America, they're totally affordable. Why? There's foreign competition. When there wasn't foreign competition, they weren't quite as affordable as they are now. The same thing we believe applies to medicine, which says that foreign competition will make American medicine more affordable. And a big part of that is allowing people who have medical training, mental health training, alternative medicine training in other countries should be allowed to practice and offer their service in America. It doesn't mean you have to use them. If you don't believe in that, that's fine. If you're like, I only want an American doctor, fine. If you're like, I only believe in this type of mental health, fine. But if you believe that this other person can help you, we believe that you have an absolute right to seek the kind of help that you need or that you just want without any interference from anyone else.
Okay, what about migration to America and green card, et cetera?
So immigration is a very big question for us. The simple answer of immigration for the Libertarian Party is we believe in a combination of open borders and no welfare. That means that that people should be welcome to come to America to seek opportunities, to create opportunities. What we have right now is the exact opposite of that. Right now in America, we have something called an H-1 cap, which says that the number of highly skilled labor, highly skilled workers, those who contribute the most to businesses, those who traditionally have the lowest crime rates, those who can bring so many advantages, those are so valuable. And there's nothing more valuable to an economy than human creativity, human skill, human genius. Those are the people that are being actively and aggressively kept out. And we think that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. In America, if you want to come to America just to start a business, you're saying, listen, I'm an entrepreneur. I want to come to America. I want to start a business, create jobs. As far as I've ever seen, that's basically impossible. I mean, there's no real visa to do that. You have to come over on a student visa, do some semi-gray market illegal type stuff, and then you could maybe get away with it. But there's no simple way for entrepreneurs to come over here. And we believe that that is exactly wrong. Our last presidential candidate, Gary Johnson, said it so well, where he says his view on immigration is this. You have a criminal background check. You have a disease check to make sure that you don't pose a major public health risk, and that's it, nothing else. And there's many different views among libertarians, but the overall view is come to America, come bring your hard work, bring your excellence, bring your innovation, make America great, have more innovations, have more jobs. That's what we want to see. So we're generally very strongly in favor of immigration. Mm-hmm.
Really interesting views.
So, yeah, yes. I do like a lot of what I've read about the Libertarian Party's views, and I don't identify with any religion or political affiliations or ideologies, but I do like a lot of what I've heard about the Libertarians' free trade, free market, laissez-faire sort of ideologies or principles, which I think are excellent, because we do strongly believe in personal sovereignty and personal choice for the individual to decide you know, how they want to. I mean, because there is a, there's always been a question of, can people actually govern themselves?
I mean, I don't think there's always been that question. I think that question is a recent fabrication of those who believe in one or the other form of totalitarianism. I don't think that for most of history that the question of the state defending people from themselves could have been taken seriously, because it would have been seen as absurd. They would say, what business does the state have to tell you what food to eat, what to drink, what to smoke, how to enjoy yourself? I mean, it's, and I think that that idea is a very problematic idea. The idea, when you say that we need the state to protect people from themselves, we're now saying that a person is by his nature or by her nature, someone who cannot think for themselves, someone who is weak, someone who is problematic, someone who is somehow inferior to the state. And we don't hold to that for a second. We believe that the evidence and natural rights both say individuals make better decisions. No matter how financially irresponsible a person I've ever seen in my life, I've never seen somebody that has run up the kind of debts, for example, that the average government has.
I can't argue with that.
That's very true.
This is a controversial statement, and I did do asset forfeiture for a tax department quite a while back, and it wasn't pleasant. There was some interesting situations that came up in doing that, people are with the tax departments. They're often, you know, we pay our taxes and they use it as they do. And if you don't file your returns on time, or if you don't pay your taxes on time when it's asked of you, you can lose your license. All sorts of penalties can be imposed. And I came up with this joke, and then they probably won't appreciate this, but how about if we hold our sort of our economic regulators or our policymakers to a higher standard, even a higher standard than the taxpayers? If they mismanage our funds, maybe they should be penalized or even imprisoned for, you know, for going into the net, running up a debt, a trillion-dollar debt. You know, I mean, it's
and I mean that does happen. I mean that what happens in the private sector. You know, we talk about Social Security. I mean, Social Security to me is a major problem, because it's forcing everyone to pay into a retirement that is unprotected. If you buy a retirement annuity in America, and they steal from it, they embezzle all that. You know, they're going to go to jail. They're going to do their best to find a way to get you your money back. But in America, the Social Security system has been raided so many times with impunity. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court has actually said that having paid into Social Security is not a guarantee of ever getting anything from Social Security. Now, imagine if an annuity, if a private sector retirement said, listen, just because you've paid us for a retirement, that's no guarantee that you're going to get a retirement. No, I mean, that'd be seen as insane. So we strongly believe that having the government involved in those things is exactly wrong, because they've A, shown they can't do it, and B, it's your choice to figure out what type of retirement you want, whether you want one that has been historically mismanaged again and again and again, that is openly declared that just because you pay them doesn't mean they're ever going to pay you, or if you want to find something better.
Interesting. Very interesting. And the Libertarian Party must be the only party that is anti-militarization. I must say, I love that, except that you have to demilitarize the whole world, I guess, to make that a safe stance. So
I'd like to hear about this.
Yeah, so our military, our views in the military are very different from those held by the Democratic or Republican Party, which is that we believe that a military should be used for defense only. That means we do not believe that the U.S. should be involved in somebody else's civil war. We believe that most or all of the foreign bases that the U.S. currently has should be closed, that those soldiers should be brought home. So our view on military policy is very, very different from those of the other parties. We believe in using trade instead. A common saying in the Libertarian Party is make trade, not war. And that comes from a deep belief that says that when you engage in trade, not only are you buying and selling goods, but you're also sharing values. As a simple example, if somebody from Iran wants to sell something to someone in America, they're probably going to have to learn a little bit about American values. Libertarian Party believes that American values are so good, so convincing, that they will speak for themselves. We don't need to bomb people into accepting our values. We believe that our values are great, and that people who embrace these ideas of free market capitalism, of personal freedom, of equal treatment of the genders, those are the things that we think are such good ideas that exposing people to them nonviolently is going to be more than sufficient, and that actually exposing them to them violently is more likely to turn them off.
We haven't seen any problem solved by dropping a bomb. It just requires you to drop bigger bombs and more bombs in order to try to solve the problem. And then it never gets solved because we've had the same war, I think, or the same wars for the last 2,000 years or more, really. I mean, we've had different wars, but essentially, I mean, when you look at it. But anyhow, maybe I'm right or wrong. I don't know if I'm right or wrong about that, but that's just...
So obviously very passionate about government, but you're also passionate about education. So I understand that you've created a system of education called the Vora Education.
Sure.
And you've also written a book on how to make your child excel at maths, the equation for excellence. Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about that.
Sure. So I got involved in education. I really started experimenting when I myself was a teenager, trying to find different ways to do education. But I've been doing it full time since about 2001. And the amazing thing that I've seen in education is that in the parts that are not controlled by regulation, not controlled by government, you see this huge wealth of innovation, of finding ways to make things more cost effective, more affordable, sometimes even free. I mean, we have great education companies in America that don't charge you a single cent, and they are competing with other educational companies that are also free. It's like you have free products competing with other free products. That's something that to me comes from unregulated innovation. And so my own work in education is part of that world of education, that world of non-state regulated or sanctioned or subsidized education. The Vora method specifically was designed to answer this question, which is, could we do in group classes what we do in tutoring? Could we make a group program, which, you know, by their nature tend to be much more affordable, could we in our group programs find a way to do what we could only previously do in tutoring? And that central question is what guides the entire Vora method. It's this idea of finding ways to make that work. We are constantly innovating there. You know, we've built apps that help you with vocabulary. But the basic idea is, in our classroom, we believe in a constant interaction between the teacher and the student. We believe that, for example, in our class, if somebody is doing a math problem and they make a mistake on multiplication, then we have that student immediately switch to a worksheet about multiplication. In other words, we don't want kids to just be skimming over things and not really mastering them, but we want to teach for that deep, thorough level of mastery. And what allows that kind of innovation, what allows us to change what we're doing, our strategies and techniques, you know, day after day, week after week, is the fact that we do not have to contend with that kind of government regulation. If we did, we couldn't do what we do. So what I want to see happening in education is getting the government completely out of education. I want to see that same thing happening in all industries that should be innovative, is removing the government, creating that type of freedom.
Wow. Do you think any student can be made to like maths?
I don't know about like. I think that any student can learn to be good. It can be made to be good at it. I mean, there's people often joke that I'm the like smartest anti-intellectual that they've met, which might be true, because there's people who are great at math. They appreciate the beauty of math, all that kind of stuff. That's never really been me. I've been somebody that I believe that math has some interesting application. You know, I find a lot of the advanced proofs to be, you know, interesting, but I'm not moved by math the way that other people who are usually really good at math are very moved by math. So I think that anyone can learn to be good at it. I'm not sure if anybody can learn to like it.
One of the things I was about to say One of the things that most impresses me about you, Arvin, is when I read your bio, I was expecting someone to be highly intellectual and, you know, you're involved in politics and here you are, and you're very personable and you're very open and, you know, you're smiling the whole time throughout this interview. And it wasn't what I was expecting from your bio when I read it, because you've got so many accomplishments and achievements and you're doing so much. I'm very, you know, pleased with the...
Well, I guess just because someone gets perfect scores on the GRE and GMAT doesn't mean he's going to be boring, does it?
I appreciate that, guys.
Are you a member of Mensa?
I think I have the test scores required. I just haven't gotten around to signing up. You know, of course, I have the greatest respect for Mensa. I just haven't personally gotten around to signing up for it.
But you're very down to earth and just.
It's good to see people like you who are quite creative and who are, you know, very much for personal sovereignty, being in a political party and possibly influencing the whole way government runs.
Yeah, I mean that's you know really what brought me to education, what brings me to politics. I mean, people see that I'm doing these two unrelated things, but to me they're very closely related, because in order to really achieve individual sovereignty, you need to have two things. One, you need to not have somebody physically stopping you. So you can't have a government saying, yeah, you have this good idea for a business, but you can't do it. Yeah, you could be a great chef, but you can't be one. So you need to have somebody who's not physically stopping you. That's important. But just because there's somebody not physically stopping you doesn't mean you're automatically going to achieve. And so the reason that I work in education is because I so deeply believe that every person has that some kind of genius within themselves, something about them that's great, that they just need to have the both the political freedom, but also that personal courage, that personal permission that says, you know, just because this other person went to some famous culinary school and you just learned cooking from your grandma, that doesn't mean that you can't run a food truck, that you can't one day run a restaurant, that you can't do these great things. You know, just because you maybe don't like math that much but you happen to really like drawing, that doesn't mean that you can't achieve great things in business. And that's why I'm so excited to see growth in things like the gig economy that really bring that. And so to me, education, that idea of individual empowerment and political freedom, the idea of, you know, removing the blockades from individual empowerment, they really go together for me. They're to me really a single pursuit.
That's really great that you say that. I really like that you say that and see that in people.
Have you ever thought of running your own school with a different school system? Because our school system at the moment is very regimented and unfortunately does crush a lot of individual creativity. I love the ideas that you're discussing, proposing. And I think our schools would be a much better place if they had those values.
Yeah, so we're doing a few things right now. One is in our after-school and weekend programs, our fourth method programs, a lot of our students have sort of gradually migrated to making those their actual place that they learn. And then, you know, some of them will just go to school and just kind of hang out there and you know, just, you know, try not to get into too much trouble. We've also seen many, many more people in America engage in homeschooling and unschooling, which are all these different ways of really being part of that totally free market of education, finding what works for your kid, not saying, let me pick this textbook or this other nearly identical textbook, but let's look at all the different amazing choices of education. What's going to work for me? What's going to work for my child? Those are the type of things that we're so excited to see. We're also currently in the process of building an online academy. We call it Vora Academy, and it's the idea of taking these principles and really creating something that's exciting, that's engaging, that's really informed by so much of what we've done in modern educational innovation, what we've, you know, learned about from classical educational innovation. So it's the free market of education, there's never been a better time to be in it. It's so exciting. And what to me is the big tragedy is so few people have access to it. And I don't mean financial access, because a lot of the stuff is free and the rest of it's, you know, honestly pretty affordable, but psychological access. The government has spent so much time using both legal force and propaganda saying that you have to go to this type of school, it has to look like this, and it has to only do things this way, And that is kind of removed more of a psychological permission. The nice thing in America is that's being turned around. The number of homeschoolers has increased from, you know, a few thousand to now over something in the neighborhood of 2 million. And so we are seeing that change. And I'm so excited to see that change.
Mm. I have a friend who homeschooled his children, and the children did very well. And they're going on to universities, and they're very intelligent, very well behaved, and very respectful, and very creative. And so it does work under the right conditions. I think children can do very well being homeschooled, with, you know, even better than with the general academic curriculums and requirements of public school systems. So would you like to give us some links, website links for our listeners?
Sure, sure. So if you want to learn about, you know, my personal business, it's voramethod.com. And if you want to learn about the Libertarian Party, and it doesn't matter what country you're in, because there's so many people that are involved in the liberty movement in their home country that we find ways to connect them and all that kind of stuff, please go to lp.org. You'll find so many ways that you can be involved online, and if you're in America, in your state. If you're in another country, you know, some of our former national chairs are currently involved in working with libertarian parties in other countries and building this as a real international movement. So I would say lp.org is the most important place to go.
Okay. And can we ask you about your political ambitions? I just want to say that I'm not that overly interested in politics. I don't even know really about the politics in Australia, and I'll just, anybody that engages me in a political discussion, I'm not sure that I could be knowledgeable and talk about it the way most people would. But I think that you probably do need to know how to survive in any political arena. But to be a successful leader, I think you need to get out of politics. So that's feeling.
It's an interesting situation. In the Libertarian Party, what we usually see is that there's kind of two roles for Libertarian candidates. Generally speaking, our higher level candidates, our top of the ticket candidates, have a lower chance of winning. And that's some of it psychological, some of it's due to legal hurdles, whatever. But they have a lower chance of winning, but they're most able to present a kind of a inspiration to other people. They bring more people into the movement, and they can really draw in the people that later become successful candidates, usually at the local level. We saw that with the Gary Johnson campaign in 2016, that even though Gary Johnson had a low chance of winning, he had a very high chance of making a huge difference in the Libertarian Party, which he did. And because of his massively successful campaign that shattered all previous records, we have so many people involved now at the state level, at the county level, that are the backbone of both the organization and the movement. Because as you're probably, you know, seeing, that our movement isn't purely like, hey, can we win this election, but can we really change the way things are being done in America? I'm personally going to be running for Senate in 2018 for the U.S. Senate here in Maryland. And my goal is to really bring home this message of what a smaller government can do, what a libertarian message and a libertarian lifestyle can do to really help people. So that's where I'm going to be doing. The website for that is votevora.com.
But I think everybody should visit that, click that link and vote for Vora.
I'm all for that. I certainly love the values. And I guess the Libertarian Party doesn't – I mean, I'm aware of the fact that there are two major parties in America, and I'm not sure whether it's ever possible for a non-Democrat or non-Republican to win because of the majority of people voting. But I guess there's a lot of influence that parties like yours can make. Do you ever see the Libertarian Party as actually winning?
It's the third largest political party in the United States.
So the question is, and when people say winning, they usually mean winning for president. Mm-hmm. And so to that, I would say yes, but I'll kind of explain the how that would be possible. In terms of winning for you know, like lower level office, I mean, it's both possible and has happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have elected officials right now for that matter. But let's talk about the idea of what victory means for the Libertarian Party. Because we could, if our goal was simply to just get somebody elected, we could simply just change our platform or we could all just join a different party. I mean, that's there are ways to just get elected for the sake of getting elected. But our goal isn't just, can we get elected just to get elected? Our goal is to change things in a very substantial way. And the question is, can we change things in a substantial way? And there the answer is absolutely. Here's why. First, often the Libertarian Party, because we do have a pretty significant media reach, because we do get ideas out there, can put ideas out there that people will demand for in order to vote for somebody. So, for example, if due to libertarian activism, say 5% of people want to legalize marijuana, it's obviously a lot higher than that, but let's say it was just 5%, and let's say current polling showed that the margin of between two candidates was only 4%, now each candidate has a reason to adopt that as part of their platform in order to win over that 5%. Now, of course, it's not really 5%, it's more like 60%, but just as an illustration. And we've seen that actually happening, both the legislators adopting our position on legalizing marijuana, as well as citizens saying, hey, this is a pretty good idea, let's do a referendum. And citizens have simply voted those things in over the legislatures. Legislatures actually, out of fear of referendums, have started doing it on their own so they can at least, you know, get something that they would like out of it. Maybe some kind of a tax or something like that. Because when citizens do it, they're just like, yeah, it's legal now. No ifs, ands, or buts. You know, there's no special privileges. So there's a kind of a race happening right now. Who can do it first? The citizens or the legislators? To me, you know, it's ideally citizens, but it's kind of a win either way type situation. So we can influence politics in those very significant ways, making huge changes. And we've seen, as our party has grown, as we've become more organized, that more and more of our big policy changes have gotten into the mainstream and have just been passed into law. So in that way, we can make major changes. Right now, we're working on combining the outreach that happens with our big ticket candidates, as well as the actual electoral victories that happen with our local candidates and our state candidates, to really try to leverage that to build up an infrastructure for a presidential win in 2020 or 2024 or 2028, you know, whatever it takes. One of the really heartening things has been seeing people leaving, elected people leaving the Democratic and Republican parties, and saying that while there's a political advantage to being part of those parties, I didn't get involved into politics just for advantage. I got in politics because I wanted to do the right thing. And so some of them have actually switched. Seating legislators have actually switched to the Libertarian Party. And it's you know, been a phenomenal change. It's something that I've never seen happening at this scale or really much at all in my time. But in the last year, things have vastly changed.
Well, that's really exciting to hear. I actually found out about I'd heard of the Libertarian Party, obviously, but there was a person in our Facebook group, on our Universal Soul Love group, who apparently chairs one of the states. I can't remember which one, because this was about a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. That kind of piqued my interest in reading up a little bit on what the Libertarian Party's views are. And
yeah, I'm just fascinated to learn that there's a party that's so pro-sovereign and individual views, mm-hmm. rather than organizing the people and telling the people what to do. Certainly the role of the individual has been a powerful one over the last decade, and America is very much seen as the land of the individual, but in fact it isn't. It's very controlled, much more so than people realize.
I mean we often look at the things that caused, you know, the founding fathers of America. You know, some, you know, founding fathers is kind of a stretch, and some of them were teenagers, but, you know, the founding fathers of America, the things that caused them to engage in full-scale revolt against, you know, their government at the time, the British Empire, were minor compared to the massive incursions that we now have taken for granted. And a big part of what we do is to encourage people to start to see those things, to say, look at this. By what right does somebody tell you how to enjoy yourself? By what right does somebody say that if you do this thing that hurts no one else, they're going to lock you up in a cage? By what right does somebody say to you that because you don't have half of a law degree and can't figure out these 50,000 forms, you're not allowed to sell food to your friends and neighbors? You know, one of my personal principles is that when I can, rather than going to a restaurant, I'll try to, there's a lot, there's a kind of a cottage industry. It's an underground, unlicensed, I assume entirely illegal industry of people cooking food in their houses and selling it. And I want to support things like that because I'm saying it is your right. It is not, the government does not have a right to tell you that you can't sell food to me. I like your food. You like this money. Let's make it, let's make an exchange. And that kind of stuff to me is so empowering to people when they say, wow, I can be an individual, a sovereign, independent individual with no one's approval, with just these skills that I've developed. I mean, that to me is something that I want to see happening everywhere. And I'm so excited to be able to be part of that, both politically and here at the local level.
Wow, what a human rights individual advocate you are. Yeah. I had no idea that there was an underground restaurant movement. have to look into that.
Yeah, see whether there's one in Australia. Yeah, a lot of great mothers. Right. And some, I mean, the food is fantastic because, again, it's, you know, a grandmother who's there, who's passionate about cooking. You know, her kids, you know, have moved out many years ago, but she still wants to do that. Her cooking quality, her concerns are going to be different than a mass market fast food chain that's just looking at the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a wonderful thing to encourage, because to me, that grandma who's now an entrepreneur is now going to be talking to her grandkids and saying, hey, listen, you don't need anybody's, you know, maybe one of her grandkids is a great graphic designer. Maybe one of her grandkids is great at making things. And she'll say, listen, you don't need anybody's approval. If you want to make something big, go on Kickstarter. If you don't want to do Kickstarter, just make something, see if somebody will buy it. And those are the type of things that to me make this movement so exciting and so satisfying, because we're making that easier.
Mm. It's here for Rebel Grandma Kitchens.
Yeah, I do remember I was hired once to try to get someone deported who was sort of illegally operating a business out of their home. And that was a tactic used to try to get this person deported. Mm. By a family member. I really can't go into my cases, obviously, but I've seen all sorts of situations over the last 25 years.
You're very right. The individual rights, we have the right to do what we want to, as long as we don't hurt others.
Yes.
We have the right for our individual expression, and it's about time that this the tyranny of organized government was loosened up.
We have natural birthrights, and I've heard you say the words natural rights quite a few times, that's perfectly in alignment with our own views. So I also appreciate the fact that you haven't spoken out negatively against anyone, other politicians and people can do that. That's fine. I mean, my own personal manner is that when I look at someone who's going to be a potential leader or wants to be elected to any kind of leadership position, I'm not interested in hearing them put down the other candidates. I want to hear what you have to offer, what your views are, what you can do. You know, it's easy to win, quote unquote, win by putting the other candidate down or the opposition down and saying what they're against and what they're going to do wrong in the future or what they've done wrong in the past in their personal lives. But I think it's much more important to tell people what you stand for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Isn't that that's a better way?
Yeah. And that's you'll see that that's a very common thing in the Libertarian Party, where candidates we're not here to, you know, I mean of course there are going to be times in debate where we're going to disagree, and we're often going to strongly disagree with proposals of other candidates, but to us, we're not trying to say, hey, look at this person, he had, you know, these personal difficulties in his youth, look at this person, his lifestyle is different from what you would like, you know, maybe this person, you know, has a different personal life than what you approve of. We're not trying to distract people, because to me those are just distractions. We don't want people distracted. We want people like focused and engaged and learning about how a better political system. We feel we don't need smoke and mirrors, because the actual thing that we actually want is something that we believe works, that history has shown does work, that when it has been tried in the modern era does work. And so those are the things that we want to see happen. We're not here to distract anybody. We're here to bring attention to the actual ideas and the actual policies that we want to see.
Excellent.
Well, thank you very much. That was Arvin Vora from the Libertarian Party. Really lovely talking to you.
Thank you, Arvin. I'm so glad we did this interview. This was fantastic.
So goodbye from us. This is Universal Soul Love, Dr. Lana Love.
And Detective David Love.
Until next week. Bye for now.
Bye for now.